Chapter 6. Drawing in the female figure. Jack sitting for his picture is a very pleasing group, and savors of the manner of Hogarth, who is introduced in the company. The murder of Trenchard must be noticed too as remarkable for the effect and terrible vigor which the artist has given to the scene. The Lesden churchyard has great merit too, but the gems of the book are the little vignettes illustrating the escape from Newgate. Here too, much anatomical care of drawing is not required. The figures are so small that the outline and attitude need only to be indicated, and the designer has produced a series of figures quite remarkable for reality and poetry too. There are no less than 10 of Jack's feet so described by Mr. Cruikshank. Let us say a word here in praise of the excellent manner in which the author has carried us through the adventure. Here is Jack clattering up the chimney, now peering into the lonely red room, now opening the door between the red room and the chapel. What a wild, fierce, scared look he has, the young ruffian, as cautiously he steps in, holding light his bar of iron. You can see by his face how his heart is beating. If anyone were there. But no. And this is a very fine characteristic of the prince, the extreme loneliness of them all. Not a soul is there to disturb him, woe to him who should, and Jack drives in the chapel gate, and shatters down the passage door, and there you have him on the leads. Up he goes. It is but a spring of a few feet from the blanket, and he is gone abiat, evasit, erupit. Mr. Wilde must catch him again if he can. We must not forget to mention Liver Twist, and Mr. Cruikshank's famous designs to that work. Asterisk, asterisk, the sausage scene at Fagin's, Nancy seizing the boy, that capital piece of humor, Mr. Bumble's courtship, which is even better in Cruikshank's version than in Boz's exquisite account of the interview, Sykes' farewell to the dog, and the Jew, the dreadful Jew that Cruikshank drew. What a fine touching picture of melancholy desolation is that of Sykes and the dog. The poor cur is not too well drawn, the landscape is stiff and formal, but in this case the faults, if faults they be, of execution rather add to than diminish the effect of the picture. It has a strange, wild, dreary, broken-hearted look. We fancy we see the landscape as it must have appeared to Sykes, when ghastly and with bloodshot eyes he looked at it. As for the Jew in the dungeon, let us say nothing of it. What can we say to describe it? What a fine homely poet is the man who can produce this little world of mirth or woe for us. Does he elaborate his effects by slow process of thought, or do they come to him by instinct? Does the painter ever arrange in his brain an image so complete that he afterwards can copy it exactly on the canvas, or does the hand work in spite of him? Asterisk or his new work, The Tower of London, which promises even to surpass Mr. Cruikshank's former productions. A great deal of this random work, of course, every artist has done in his time. Many men produce effects of which they never dreamed, and strike off excellences, haphazard, which gain for them reputation. But a fine quality in Mr. Cruikshank, the quality of his success, as we have said before, is the extraordinary earnestness and good faith with which he executes all he attempts, the ludicrous, the polite, the low, the terrible. In the second of these he often, in our fancy, fails, his figures lacking elegance and descending to caricature. But there is something fine in this too. It is good that he should fail, that he should have these honest naive notions regarding the beau monde, the characteristics of which a namby-pamby tea party painter could hit off far better than he. He is a great deal too downright and manly to appreciate the flimsy delicacies of small society. You cannot expect a lion to roar you like any sucking dove, or frisk about a drawing room like a lady's little spaniel. If then, in the course of his life and business, he has been occasionally obliged to imitate the ways of such small animals, he has done so, let us say it at once, clumsily, and like as a lion should. Many artists, we hear, hold his works rather cheap. They prate about bad drawing, want of scientific knowledge. They would have something vastly more neat, regular, anatomical. Not one of the whole band most likely, but can paint an academy figure better than himself. Nay, or a portrait of an alderman's lady and family of children. But look down the list of the painters, and tell us who are they? How many among these men are poets, makers, possessing the faculty to create, the greatest among the gifts with which Providence has endowed the mind of man? Say how many there are, count up what they have done, and see what in the course of some 29 years has been done by this indefatigable man. What amazing energetic fecundity do we find in him? As a boy he began to fight for bread, has been hungry twice a day we trust, ever since, and has been obliged to sell his wit for his bread week by week. And his wit, sterling gold as it is, will find no such purchasers as the fashionable painter's thin pinchbeck, who can live comfortably for 6 weeks, when paid for and painting a portrait, and fancies his mind prodigiously occupied all the while. There was an artist in Paris, an artist hairdresser, who used to be fatigued, and take restoratives, after inventing a new coiffure. By no such gentle operation of headdressing as Cruikshank lived. Time was, we are told, so in print, when for a picture with 30 heads, in it he was paid 3 guineas a poor week's pittance truly, and a dire week's labor. We make no doubt, that the same labor would at present bring him 20 times the sum, but whether it be ill paid or well, what labor has Mr. Cruikshank's been? Week by week, for 30 years, to produce something new. Some smiling offspring of painful labor, quite independent and distinct from its 10,000 jovial brethren, in what hours of sorrow and ill health, to be told by the world, make us laugh, or you starve give us fresh fun, we have eaten up the old and are hungry. And all this has he been obliged to do to wring laughter day by day, sometimes, perhaps, out of want, often certainly from ill health or depression, to keep the fire of his brain perpetually alight. For the greedy public will give it no leisure to cool. This he has done and done well. He has told 1,000 truths in as many strange and fascinating ways. He has given 1,000 new and pleasant thoughts to millions of people. He has never used his wit dishonestly. He has never, in all the exuberance of his frolicsome humor, caused a single painful or guilty blush. How little do we think of the extraordinary power of this man, and how ungrateful we are to him. Here, as we are come round to the charge of ingratitude, the starting post from which we set out, perhaps we had better conclude. The reader will perhaps wonder at the high-flown tone in which we speak of the services and merits of an individual, whom he considers a humble scraper on steel, that is wonderfully popular already. But none of us remember all the benefits we owe him. They have come one by one driving out the memory of the other. It is only when we come to examine them all together, as the writer has done, who has a pile of books on the table before him, a heap of personal kindnesses from George Cruikshank, not presents, if you please, for we bought, borrowed, or stole every one of them, that we feel what we owe him. Look at one of Mr. Cruikshank's works, and we pronounce him an excellent humorist. Look at all. His reputation is increased by a kind of geometrical progression. As a whole diamond is 100 times more valuable than the 100 splinters into which it might be broken would be. A fine rough English diamond is this about which we have been writing. End of Project Gutenberg's A Text of George Cruikshank, by W.M. Thackeray. Crook by Gutenberg Edition.